at Supply Posse. I'm joined today by Gina Marie Cincinnati. If that name is familiar to you, it could be because Gina first joined us back in episode 164 to discuss her life and work as a collage artist. Now, I'll just give you a heads up. If you haven't actually listened to that episode, push pause now, go and give it a listen, and then return, because trust me, things will make so much more sense if you do. Hi, Gina. Welcome back to the Posse.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me back today. I'm happy to talk to you again.
yours is a conversation that, like, I get inspired by everybody I speak to, but there are definitely some artists who, for one reason or another, I connect with more, or we just, you know, and then we keep in touch, usually via DM on Instagram, because it's just, you know, so easy. And you're definitely one of those. I love not only seeing your work and your progress and stuff, but just chatting, just day-to-day stuff is fun. So it's a delight to have you back today.
Thank you.
So since we spoke last, since we recorded episode 164, there's been an awful lot that has happened in your world. Big things, big changes. And that's why you're here today, really, because I guess there's a lot of things we can talk about what it's like to move from one side of the world to the other, but also what it's actually like to prepare yourself and your art for an exhibition that isn't in the place you were living in at the time. So I sort of, because that's a process in itself, I would imagine. And I think that's where we should start. Let's start with, well, first of all, share with the listeners exactly where this exhibition was, a little bit about it, history maybe or something. And then I want to sort of dive in a bit about what it's like to send your artwork off for an exhibition, but then you sent yourself off to go and see and see that actual artwork and to be there live and in person. So let's talk.
Okay. So for those who maybe haven't heard episode 164 yet, I was preparing to show my artwork at the 24th Florence Biennale, which was located in Florence, Italy, in October of 2023. And I, at the time, was living in Japan. And it was quite a lot. Should I talk about the preparations of getting the art over there? Should I just go for it?
Absolutely, okay. Yes, because I think it's fascinating. And, you know, even if people listening have no intention ever of exhibiting their work or anything like that, I still think there's so much value in learning what goes on behind the scenes, because I think as somebody who would, you know, perhaps next time they step into an art gallery or somewhere where they're seeing art on display, I think it would kind of help to know a bit more about how that work got there, like not just the creating of it, which is incredibly important, but there's still so much behind the scenes that you just don't really know and hear about. Like, you know, what's it like to get that art prepared and going to deadlines and then sending it off? And I'm sure there's probably paperwork and all sorts of things involved. So I need to know.
Okay. I will tell you everything, and I'm going to try to keep this succinct. The first thing that I will tell you, Kim, is that I did not ship my artwork directly to Italy, because that would have been my first time shipping to Italy. And I had shipped my art to Germany before, and I've shipped my art to Spain, and I've shipped a lot of art to the UK. So what I thought would be better, because I was planning to go to the exhibition, I wanted to... Oh, time out. Right now I'm sitting in the UK. I moved to England with my husband.
Oh, We need to say that too, don't we? Yeah.
Because that's actually the biggest part of this is England, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so like I said, I already had a lot of experience shipping my artwork to the UK. And for anybody out there who has experience shipping their artwork internationally, you probably know the mail carrier you prefer to use. You probably know the shipment time and the cost and the process and all of that. And that was kind of where I was, where I was using a fabulous Japanese company called EMS. And I worked with them all the time, and I trusted this company to ship my artwork across the world. And everything was always a very fast and secure and efficient process. And so I thought, I was afraid to ship. I was afraid to travel without these babies of mine, these three artworks that I would show at the Biennale. I was so afraid of anything happening to them. And I thought, well, the one thing I know is that I can ship EMS to the UK. I'm going to ship it to my in-laws because that's safe. It's basically shipping to myself. And that was going to be fine. And if there's anybody out there right now who's wondering why I did not bring the artwork on the plane with me, it's because I was flying Air France with two cats, the remains of a dead cat, and a mini fridge full of my own medication. So I did not want to further complicate the process by buying an extra airline seat. Yes, you heard that right. Air France wanted me to pay for an extra airline seat to ship my artwork. So it was too much. It was really too much. So I just said, okay, I'm going to trust EMS and I'm going to ship the artwork to my in-laws. And the getting there process was fine. You know, EMS sends you emails and tells you where your artwork, where your package is and all that. But what I didn't expect was for, this was the first time I shipped a piece of art so large that I claimed a higher value on the art, which is something maybe a lot of you know, that when you ship things internationally, you have to say how much the value is of something. Mm-hmm. And I claimed a value that was, you know, obviously less than I would sell it for, but about what I spent in materials for it. And because that number was more than 50 pounds, it got held up in customs and I basically had to pay a ransom to get it out when I got to the UK. it was being held hostage by the customs facility, and I couldn't even just go walk in and pay for it because it was like a 4-hour drive away. So I had to communicate by email, and that was the first hurdle. And then we've got the artwork. Let's just say I got the artwork. I paid too much for it, but whatever. I got the artwork. And then the other thing that was happening in all of this is that the Biennale, you know, it's the 24th Biennale. So they've been doing this work for what then? 48 years, mm-hmm. I guess. And I think they know what they're doing for the most part. And that said, I think that the reason that their emails were so strongly worded, which I will explain next, is that they had some trouble in the past before, because I've seen contracts written that were strongly worded, and it's because somebody did something bad once, and now we're going to protect ourselves forever from this happening again. And the thing I want to tell people about is the ATA carnet. Do you know, Kim, what a carnet is?
I have no idea, none at all. But I'm fascinated. This feels like some kind of like detective novel or something. Like I am so into this, and I just need to know everything.
Well, thankfully, I have a whole binder full of everything. I'm not going to go through every page in that today. but I think you know me by now, and you know that I have to have binders of all the documents because that's how organized I am. But so this ATA carnet, so something else to keep in mind for the listeners, we're now living in a post-Brexit UK.
Yes. Oh, yes, of course. Of course.
If I had done this 4 years ago, this wouldn't have been a problem because they still hadn't actually... to quote them, got Brexit done at that point. But I was living in the UK after Brexit had officially been done. And so everything just got a whole lot harder. And the Biennale is extremely organized, and they're dealing with people coming from all over the world. And the thing I want to tell you is that the ATA carnet is basically an expensive passport for your art. You have to get... Like you could get your pets a passport, even though I didn't get my pets a passport because they're not EU pets. But the ATA carnet, Florence was saying, if you are coming from a carnet country, you need to have this ATA carnet. And if you're not coming from a carnet country, because they are split into carnet countries and non-carnet countries.
Of course.
Yeah, I know. And I would tell you that for the most part, it seems a very global north, global south. That seems okay. Like the division, as far as I'm aware. Because my friends that I met from Argentina did not do a carnet. And so if you don't do the carnet, then you're going to roll into Italy with your art, probably at an airport. And if you declare this stuff at customs, which you're supposed to, and you can't see me, but I'm using my fingers to make air quotes. You have to pay the value added tax. You have to pay the VAT, right? So 20%. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I will tell you now, I probably could have got away with doing the VAT also, but because I'm me, I needed to make sure everything was done right and by the book to the letter. And so I followed the instructions explicitly. But the ATA carnet is once again, you're petitioning the government to be allowed to take your artwork out to do a thing. And you have to go through all this stuff. You have to talk to your local chamber of commerce, and they're going to help you do an application. This is the thing that really got me, is that once again, I did not value my art at what it would be sold for or what I would charge for it, because they're charging you for the cost of your carnet based on the value of your art. And this is something I cannot stress enough to people who have to do this in the future. Unless it's like something plated in gold, don't write down the value of the art, because you're going to get charged so much for this document. And it's so frustrating and it's so annoying. But the reason I chose to undervalue my art for just materials in the event of damage was because I was literally transporting it from A to B. So I felt pretty safe that I wasn't, like, if the art got damaged, I probably got damaged as well. Like, yep. If the art got damaged, it's because I was in a car accident, probably. So it kind of would have been somebody. Yeah. Anyway, so even with me valuing my art at about maybe, I think I valued it at £800 UK. I had to, my carnet cost me £400.
Oh, wow.
I know.
How long does that thing last for? Like just this one opportunity, like does it expire? Like what? I just can't.
Exactly. So just like a passport, it expires. And this carnet, I did the application. The application went relatively quickly and they delivered it to me, but the application and this carnet was good for a year. But, you know, I said I'm only using it for 3 weeks ultimately. And they just said, okay, well, you have it for a year. And once you're done, this is the worst part. Once you're done, you have to mail it back to them. You don't even get to keep it. Like, you get to, because, what? Because,
are you for real?
Because, I'm totally for real. And the reason for this is because, oh, there was so much extra on top of it. Like, I had to register my vehicle the first time I traveled, because we took the ferry from England to France. Well, on the ferry, we had to go in as freight. So it's my tiny little, like, small SUV in with all of these giant lorry trucks. And and I had to go, when you have this carnet, you have to go to an inland border facility that is linked to your port of transit. So we had to drive to this border facility, my tiny little car and all these 18 wheelers. And I had to walk into this, this kind of customs room. And of course, I'm the only woman in there for a good 45 minutes until another female trucker comes in. And then there's women working behind the desk who seem to know everybody, and they were very kind. And everybody was kind of like, well, what are you doing here? And I had to explain myself many times, because I'm this 41-year-old woman wearing like a pink satin Japanese jacket with bunnies on it. And there's all these guys in like high-vis jackets and like, you know, Dickies pants. Like, you can imagine. And my husband, my husband's sitting in the car with the art because it's me on the document. So he's the one guarding the artwork in our car. And I'm here with all of these people in this place. And everybody's like, why are you here? And at almost every single point of this journey, people were like, no, you're a tourist vehicle. You have to go in the tourist line. And I'm saying, no, I have a carnet. I need it to be stamped by you people. And they're like, oh, that's weird. Okay, then go that way with all the big trucks. So you have to get, and it's imperative that you get your carnet stamped by both the outgoing. So I had to get it stamped in England, and then I had to get it stamped in France on the other side after I got off the boat. And to save us time, it was exactly the same on the way back. I had to stamp at the tunnel in France, and then I had to stamp on the outside of the tunnel in the UK. So that's all the same. But I had to get all of these other documents. Like I said, I had to register my vehicle. I had to get my national insurance number, which I arrived in England on September 17th, and the Biennale started on October 12th. So I literally had like 3 weeks to get all this stuff done. And I think there might be a lot of people who maybe are like me and think, well, you could have just done all of this beforehand when you were in Japan. And I swear to you, listeners, I definitely tried, but there were some problems because, and I'm on the UK Gov website trying to apply for my carnet. My IP address is blocking my application and access. So then I got my sister-in-law involved. So my sister-in-law in the UK is doing the application for me, and I'm on Skype with her, or no, like FaceTime or whatever, but she's with me and she's typing in everything. And then we get to the point where it's asking for my UK bank account, and I don't have a bank account. So we have to stop the application there, and I have to come to the UK and get my residence permit and get my visa. And then I'm allowed to open a bank account, but it's going to take a week because that's how banks work. So I think, you know, it probably would have been fine if I had just done everything from Japan to Italy, but I had this wrench that I also happened to be moving countries at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What so, I think I would like to do, if I had the ability to go back in time, I would go back to whomever it was, and I know for a fact, and I'm probably going to upset some listeners, but I guarantee you it was a man who came up with the idea of this flipping thing and all this paperwork, and I will slap them silly because, oh my goodness me, what a headache, what a nightmare. Realistically, what is achieved by all of that? Like, we're not talking about a weapon. We're not talking about anything that's going to hurt somebody. We're talking about artwork for the sake of artwork, for it being a thing, to show other people, to be beautiful, to be what art is. And you have to jump through 4 million hoops. Oh, my goodness me.
I know. And it would have been easier if we had still been in the EU, because then it wouldn't have mattered. But the fact is, the UK is not in the EU anymore. And to make, I will tell you, because I was right where you are with this, Kim. I was trying to figure out what monster created this law. And the only thing I could think of is because in the carnet application, there's two art classifications. One of them is like incredibly valuable old art, like you're transporting like a Renoir or something across country lines, or it's kind of like new art. I made this myself. I'm a crafty person. Like, those are the two options. So naturally I chose the, this is arts and crafts hobbies for me, classification, because I would love to consider myself a master, but you know, I'm not that old yet. So I wonder if this is because of some kind of trafficking issue. I wonder if this is because of like the Nazi stolen artwork from World War II. You know, I do hope that this was put in as some kind of protection.
Well, sure. But if that's the case, couldn't you argue it's backfired because there is just so much paperwork to be done?
Yeah.
And I mean, real, you know, like who's actually going to want to do that? They're just going to go straight to, I mean, I don't know how this works. Clearly, I have no idea how the black market works. But you know what I mean? Like, what are your options? If you genuinely have stolen artwork that you want to sell, you're not doing paperwork. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
and I can give you my kind of takeaway from all of this. At the event, the entire time, you know, the emails were very strongly worded. You must show that you have your carnet if you're coming from a carnet country, and you will not be allowed to take your artwork and go home unless you show us your carnet and you get this export document. And I really do think that that is much more necessary for people flying on planes. But I will tell you that both I and this friend of mine from Argentina, if we hadn't been told to stop at customs and claim our artwork, we wouldn't have done it, and nobody would have thought what we were carrying was valuable artwork, and we could have just walked right into all of these countries. Like, I was driving in my car and it was just a big box, and my friend she rolled hers up in a tube because she had these big canvas paintings, and she just walked in with a tube, and nobody said anything. And she said, oh, I forgot to go to customs, and she had to double back and go through customs again. And yeah. I think that, you know, this was the time that we all got lucky. Nobody asked me to see my paperwork when I took my art. Nobody asked me to see my documents when I dropped it off. I was allowed in like anybody could have walked in. And I just hung up my artwork, and then I took it down, and nobody was really too concerned, you know? And I do feel like maybe that might be... Italian people, please forgive me, but as a person who kind of identifies slightly with Italian culture, as a person who is a third generation immigrant from the United States, from Italy, I do think that we might have got lucky that we were kind of on Italian time, that it was a lot more relaxed than it might have been if it had been in, you know, Germany, where I have also had to rescue my art from customs because it was being held hostage, and I had to explain that I drew these things myself. So I think that it's actually like really hit or miss, and you have to follow the rules or just be okay with paying that. And being okay with paying that, I will tell you, would have been a lot cheaper than doing the carnet, honestly.
Oh, what a nightmare. I just keep thinking, you know, customs should just focus on things like, you know, illegal drugs and all that sort of stuff. Like artwork, really? And I know what you say, like perhaps we're talking about old masters and things that are worth billions, but I don't know. It just, I think you've got more patience than I have. That let's just call it that.
I would say that it is patience inspired by optimism. It's going to be fine. It's the final outcome is what's most important. You know, all of that hassle and that strain on my relationship, driving 900 miles to Italy, that was totally worth it for the actual experience at the Biennale. 100%. Well, it's just the paperwork is always the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. Well, you've tidied that nicely. So you've gone through the nightmare. now you're there. Your artwork is hanging in Florence. What is that like? Like, what is that whole thing like? Because I followed along with your Instagram, and I was your daily outfit postings and photos from, you know, from the, oh, which I loved, by the way. Like, they were just the best. But what is it? What does it feel like? Like, seeing your work there? What's it like?
You know, I feel like, To hearken back to our earlier episode 164 about the art college experience, like I have seen my art hanging on walls before, but this was a totally different experience. Of course, the size of it was at the Fortezza di Basso, which is a fortress in the center of Florence, and it's basically used as a kind of exhibition and convention space. So there were something like 450 artists exhibiting there, and there was a performance space, and there were all of these talks and lectures being given, and it was really spectacular. And I will say, I got really into being there because I didn't really know what to expect, and maybe some of your listeners have already shown at these large group exhibitions. I thought that I could just hang my work up on the wall and then, you know, roll out for 5 days and enjoy my time in Florence. But that was not the case. Mm. It was clear that I had to be there. I had to have my business cards ready. I had to wait for people to come to me and talk about my art. And so I ended up really going to work every day at the Biennale, but it was totally worth it because even though I did meet a few gallery owners or people who were visiting with their own art groups from overseas, meeting the other artists was really the bomb. And you and I talked about that in 164, about being surrounded by artists being so inspiring and helpful to kind of push your craft further. And I felt like I almost got a new life purpose being there, if that makes sense.
It does. It does, actually. And thinking back to your posts at the time, like your Instagram posts during and after, it does feel like that came through. Like there was a sense of joy and excitement, but also a renewed vigor as an artist. Like it really felt like it was something that was worth everything, worth the paperwork, worth all of the back and forth and the money and that sort of stuff. Like you could definitely feel that coming off your posts, I think.
Thank you. I'm glad that came through because it was so nice to be surrounded by so many like-minded people and to be talking about, you know, the art world today and to be talking about their materials and their processes and their struggles and just, you know, finding my people and kind of choosing who you're going to stay in touch with, who you're going to keep talking to. And I feel like my arts community has vastly expanded since being there. And that, I think, even more than possibly winning some award, which doesn't even matter. It's on my resume now that I show at the Biennale, right? I don't have to have won an award while I was there, but just being there and forming those bonds and learning so much from the other artists was absolutely worth the cost.
So I'm wondering, how do you actually, both artistically and emotionally, how do you process that experience? Like, obviously we're talking about it now, and I'm sure you've spoken about it ad nauseum to your partner and, you know, those people close to you, but like, how do you sort of process all of those feelings and the experience and then distill that into your art? Is that something that sort of needs to bubble away and take time, or is it kind of a bit more immediate? I mean, obviously you've got the stopgap of moving and what that does to your creative process, but like, how does that kind of component work?
Well, you're right that I've certainly had a lot of time to think since coming back from the Biennale. And to be honest, because I'm me, and maybe you saw the reel recently about my boring sketchbook. I write more than I draw in my sketchbook. And I wrote down a lot of the things that people told me. I did kind of go immediately and find the materials that they were talking about and where I could purchase them. And after speaking with some of the people on the jury and speaking with the artists, I had ideas immediately. So I voice recorded them as I had them and I wrote them down later. And I've just been keeping reams and reams of notes about the things I want to do next and kind of using that inspiration as a bit of a catalyst to push what I'm doing this year and what I was doing as soon as I came back.
Mm-hmm. The discussions with the jury members, is that a discussion about their observations of your work? Is it a discussion about art in general? Like, I've never spoken to somebody who's, you know, on a panel judging art. Like, what's it like?
You know, to be honest, I felt pretty comfortable doing it, even though half of the jurors I spoke to didn't speak English. Thankfully, mm-hmm. I've got so much experience speaking to people of all English levels that we were able to have a conversation regardless of their English level or my Italian level, which is the other problem. But the one thing I would say about listening to the jurors is that in everything we have to think about their perspective and their context, and we can't know their preferences, but if it's a kind of guy over 50 talking to me in Florence and he's wearing something that looks like an Armani suit, then I think I can guess pretty easily what his taste in art is, you know, mm-hmm. based on his generation, based on what was popular when he was in his 20s, based on who won the awards at the exhibition later. But mm-hmm. I think the thing, and I think this is really important for artists to hear, is that everybody's going to have something to say about your art. And it might be while you're sitting in art class and your classmates get participation points for talking, so they're going to say anything that springs to mind, even if it's not relevant to what you were trying to do. And also, but also too, you know, one of the jurors told me, well, if you go bigger and stop using photographs and start drawing instead of using photographs, then you could be hanging in a hotel or a bank. And the thing for me is that I think for him, hanging in a hotel or a bank might seem like the highest point of achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly for me, my art doesn't belong in a hotel or a bank.
Yeah.
And also, my art might not be my art if I stop using photographs.
Exactly right.
So the thing is, you know, you can listen to what other people tell you about your art and their opinions, but you don't have to take everything that they say as the gospel and the only path, you know?
Yeah.
And thankfully,
No, you're right. It's okay. I'll put my thought aside for a sec. Keep going.
I was just going to finish that by saying that I rolled into Florence with an army. I brought, you know, 10 of my favorite people, friends and family. Mm-hmm. Well, I brought, they paid for their tickets. I invited them, but I had people surrounding me who love me and who know me and my art infinitely better than a random juror in Italy does. And so after talking about my discussions with the jurors, with them, all of them said the kind of same thing that I felt internally, that that's a nice idea, and it's good that he gave you the feedback, but you don't need to use all of it.
No. No, I'd be horrified, honestly, because it wouldn't be your work. Like, it wouldn't be the work I've come to know and love and so many others. Like, and I think that gets to that thing of you have to make what you want to make, what your heart tells you to make, what your soul tells you to make. You will find an audience. You will find people that love your work. And really, if that's the most important thing, is making what you want to make, not what somebody says you should make to make money or to achieve some level of, I don't know, whatever. Like, you've got to do what you want to do.
Yeah. And that was just the point of one person. And maybe the other jurors had other things that they could have said to me that would have also been possibly 50% what I needed to hear and 50% their ideas about what success looks like. And we just, you know, and I feel like regardless of where you are in your art career, there's always going to be people who have an opinion about what you should be doing. And it's nice to listen to them, but changing your art so one person might buy it is not the way to be an artist or to feel good about your art, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you have been to Florence, you have seen and taken in and loved and enjoyed the whole thing. What then... you touched on it, I touched on it right back at the start. What is it like to move from Japan to the UK? If you have listened to 164, then yep, this is not the first time you've moved from one country to another. But Gina now is a different person than Gina was last time, and touched on the fact that you had cats to move as well as art and a husband and, you know, the whole, like, what is it like? Because I can only imagine.
um, It was a lot. And it was what I did when I left Germany was a kind of smaller version of what I had to do when I left Japan. Because in Germany, I didn't have cats and I was a photographer. And I just put everything in some boxes and shipped them with a shipping container to the United States, and it was fine. But this time around, I had many more boxes and I had cats, and then the cats did not go on the shipping container. The cats were on the plane with me on Air France in cabin. So that was completely different. But, you know, it was really hard. I had to sell off my desk and I had to give away a lot of my art studio pieces just because I had a kind of budget for my shipping container cost, and mm-hmm. bringing my shelves or bringing that desk or bringing, you know, the same IKEA bookshelves you can buy everywhere. You know, I had to just think to myself, it will be cheaper to buy these again in the next country if I really need this setup again, than it would be to ship it overseas in the container, because you get charged by the cubic meter. And mm-hmm. the best way I can describe a cubic meter to people who have never shipped anything before and don't think like that, because I didn't think like that either. If you have a family size refrigerator, it's almost 6 feet tall. That's 1 cubic meter.
That's a good way of putting it.
One of the shipping company guys told me that, and it was like, I interviewed 7 shipping companies. Guy number 6 said that to me finally. Nobody else even bothered to explain. And he looked at my fridge and he's like, well, that fridge right there is about a cubic meter. And I was like, oh, that's really useful. Yeah, I think I've got about 5 of those, yeah. 6 maybe. And But the thing about moving art, so I shipped most of my remaining artworks on the container because I wanted to take a break with my shop on my website and kind of just fix things, you know. But mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking too hard, but I really did think that I would get here. I'm staying with my in-laws now, by the way, for the listeners, and I know that is a very privileged place to be, and I feel very lucky because the last time I was in the UK for 6 months, I was staying in a weekly rental room in a guest house, hemorrhaging money because my in-laws really weren't in the space to take us. So I really do appreciate that we're here with them. But I thought that I would just come here, and I know this house very well. I know every space in it. And in my mind, I thought, yeah, there's going to be space for me to make art, even though I wasn't really thinking so hard about it. And then I got here and realized I definitely there's space, but it's not space in which I am permitted to make art, if that makes sense, or make mm-hmm. my art.
Yeah.
I could sit on my computer and do my digital stuff totally fine, no problem, which is what I've been doing, but there's no space for me to get the easel out and throw gouache around and, you know, cat paint prints on the floor. But because, which is a true story, by the way, but before when I was thinking about what to bring, I actually, you know, you can pay for extra suitcase check-in for your flight. Like you usually, if it's an international flight where you're flying across an ocean, they allow you usually 2 suitcases.
Yeah.
I paid for a 5th suitcase just for my art supplies.
Good.
I brought one pack. Yeah. just of the supplies.
Well, the thing is, though, in my mind, I'm thinking of everything that you can get in Japan so easily, and I'm thinking 1 suitcase is not enough for all that stuff.
You're totally right about
realistically.
That. Yeah, you're totally right. I also rolled up about 50 sheets of my paper and put them in a shipping tube that I got from a poster company I support. And I packed that also into one of my other suitcases. So I brought a whole bunch of paper, my favorite papers that I thought I would use, and a whole bunch of gouache and the acrylic paint and the gold paint, of course, and my cutting tools and my smallest, like A4 size cutting mat and a bunch of smaller items like my palette knife and brushes and stuff. And I haven't been able to use it just because it's the nature of being here, you know. Mm.
As an in-between, so you obviously you said you can create digitally, but what is it that you're doing now? Are you letting ideas sort of come and ferment in your mind and writing them down in your sketchbook, your boring sketchbook, as you call it, which is just like so not boring, but anyway, like I imagine there would be part of you that must feel strange to not be creating, to not be making the art that you were making. Like if I think to the times when I've been sick and I haven't been able to do anything creative, it feels like part of your body is missing, like you're missing a limb in a way. And I wonder, is that something that you experience as well, or do you deal with it in a different way? Like, what's that like?
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I feel as if my hands have been cut off. And by my hands, I'm also talking about my ability to express myself, because my art was always a big part of that. Even if I wasn't necessarily expressing about my feelings today about what just happened yesterday, being able to do that art and think about it was opening me up to an expression that I didn't have otherwise. And so that's been very difficult for me. But also, I feel like after the Biennale and after all of the new ideas that kind of came flooding in and a bunch of old ideas that kind of came back up, like, hey, it's the right time to do this now. I've been trying really hard to appreciate this time as a kind of forced transition, as the kind of space to really think about what I want to do. And I do want to say also to the listeners, it is incredibly frustrating to not be making art right now, but there's so many other things that need to happen for my art to be successful that I have to see this time as the forced time to do that work. And I'm not happy about it, but what I have done, the progress I have made in not making art has actually been really useful. Like I've applied to so many art grants and I've written so many grant proposals for these much larger pieces that are going to require funding to build. And I wouldn't have had time to do that if I was just consistently making all of the artwork that I have in my sketchbook. I applied to show my art in a bunch of open calls and art exhibitions that are coming up. I made myself a spreadsheet of all of the things that I want to apply to, that it's not the time to apply to them yet. I've been doing a lot of research about other international exhibitions and other places that I would like to show that look good, you know? So all of that is what's happening now. I also applied to and was accepted to do an artist residency in February next year. So I had to sit down and take the time to do that application, and I was successful. So I might not.
Well, that's exciting. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really excited to do that. And it's 2 weeks in Portugal, and it's going to be amazing.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible.
Thanks. And another big thing that I did that I've been kind of hinting about online, but I haven't really wanted to talk about it until I had something to show for it, is that I've started an art coven with some of the people that I met at Florence.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more if you can.
Okay. Today is the day I'm writing the mission statement. Today is the day I'm making the mock pages for our website. But one of the things that we noticed at Florence, and I hope it's okay to talk about this just for a moment to go back, is that while there was a very good equal representation between male and female and religions, all of that, you know, was very kind of like basic equality was represented. However, you know, the Biennale is really pay to play, and you have to pay to be there. You have to pay to exhibit in the space, and you have to pay to get your stuff there, and it costs a lot. And we, a lot of the people that I spoke to were concerned about who wasn't there and why didn't the Biennale offer scholarships or support to people who looked like emerging excellent artists? Why weren't they here? And also, one of the people that I met is pretty visibly disabled. And for people who haven't listened to 164 yet, I am also invisibly disabled. And there was not a real visibility for anybody other than able presenting, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So we were really concerned about the lack of representation of countries from the global south and about people who don't just look healthy and able-bodied, and people who also were not, there were only, I met one person who was transgender, and, you know, and I met another person who was very openly making art about LGBTQ related topics. And where was that representation? Where was that visibility? Because obviously we all know somebody, right?
Yeah,
and so,
exactly.
And so the purpose of this international art coven that we've started is a kind of focus on the intersectionality of anybody who is classified as or identifies as female, and trying to bring all of those other parts in that would otherwise have experienced some kind of barriers to showing their art in the galleries or on a wider stage. So we're kind of collecting now. And
I'm going to write the mission statement, get the website up and running, get the Instagram going, and then we're going to try to work to find those artists who might not traditionally be approached by galleries or these types of exhibitions, to try to give voice to the people who might not have the same access to the art world as perhaps others would, just based on their socioeconomic status or their geographic location or ability or disability, you know, gender identity, that sort of thing.
That's incredibly important. It's really important work that you're doing. And I think I'm cheering you. I think it's wonderful. It's disappointing in a way to hear that the representation at the Biennale isn't what it could be, but hey, I guess maybe it's fired you up to do what you're doing. So maybe that is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was good. I think it was very useful to be there and to recognize who was missing. And I'm always interested in who's missing from settings or situations. But also too, and I do want to say this to the listeners, maybe all of us don't want to show in a gallery, or maybe all of us don't want to have our artwork hanging in some public space. I mean, most of the artists I know do want that, but they don't necessarily think or want their work to be hanging in a museum like the Louvre or anything. And I guess a part of it is access and opportunity, but another part of it might just be what works better for you, and to question whether or not the gallery setting and the people who run the galleries, all of that is somehow now getting outdated on its own, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, that's a really good point, actually, and it kind of tying back into what you were saying about the guy saying, you know, do this and that and your work would hang in a bank or whatever. Well, yeah, but that's not what you are, and that's not what your art represents. And I think you're so right. Like, I think maybe part of it is, I just had a thought that, you know, like I speak to people and some of them are reluctant to call themselves an artist. And I wonder if part of that is somewhere deep down and they're not even aware of it. It's that thought that, well, I can't be an artist because my work has never been hung in a gallery. It's never been on display for anybody. but that mm-hmm. doesn't mean you're not an artist. Like, I think all those old yeah. thoughts, those old ways of this is an artist, and if you don't do your art that way, then you're not an artist. They just need to be thrown in the bin.
Absolutely. And, you know, to go back to somebody as amazing and important as Frida Kahlo, am I a woman if I don't make babies? Like, this is the same argument, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
This is, and it's just kind of, I do think that often we are at the mercy of the generations that came before us and what they consider to be a norm or the way to do things. And to be completely honest, my parents' generation has no idea about the platform I have on the internet, to the extent that recently I was speaking with one of my mother's sisters, one of my aunts, about who follows me and who is looking at my artwork. And I was explaining that none of the people that follow me know anything about my family or know anybody from my family personally. And half of them I've never even met. And mm-hmm. at what point in the last 50 years have any of us had such access to so many people as we do now?
Yeah, that's a damn good point.
You know, how did I get to meet you? Like, how did
true.
I know how you found me, right? Thanks, Instagram.
Yeah, but, yeah, correct. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is, and I probably say it too often, but oh my goodness, thank goodness for technology. You and I would not be here having this conversation for the second time around. We would never have met in the first place. Like, it's, you know, yes, I know there is so much negativity with social media particularly and technology. And mm-hmm. At the end of the day, there's always going to be bad that goes along with the good. But my goodness me, these incredible moments, right. these connections we make with each other, they're just worth so much, I think. They're worth so much and they should be cherished.
Absolutely. And I do think that quite often when we talk about finding our people, it's so nice to find my people on the other side of the world or in a country that I've never visited that are doing something so similar and having the same thoughts that I'm having. And I wouldn't have known that 80 years ago. I would have been, you know, withering away in an upstairs bedroom, locked behind a door, being pressured to get married. You know.
Yeah. It's just how it was. And I, you know, I still sometimes find myself when I'm reading a novel or even a bit more of a historical account of some way, way, way hundreds of years ago or whatever, or not even that far away. And they talk about that, like, you know, the woman who hasn't had a child and she hasn't gotten married and how, you know, bad form that was. And I just look around and go, oh my goodness me, I'm so glad that I was not around then.
Same, completely, 100%. Yeah, everything we're doing now is completely unexpected and unimaginable to those people so uh-huh. long ago.
Yep. So we have you now in the UK. We have you house hunting, I'm imagining, or at the very least art yes. space locating. What yes. else is coming up this year? Let's sort of tie this conversation up with sort of, obviously you can't give everything away and there's probably a great deal you don't know because of the situation of where you're located and stuff, but like we are at the beginning of the year as we record this. Yes, it's going to go out in mm-hmm. probably, I don't know, 8 weeks, maybe, I don't know where we're at, but we're still early enough mm-hmm. into 2024. Oh, kitty. Hello, little kitty. I heard the kitty in the background.
Hi,
how adorable. Yeah. what do we think? What do we hope for 2024?
For 2024, the things that I have set for myself is to grow this coven that I mentioned and kind of get it up and running. That's a big priority for me. And of course, yes, mm-hmm. find the house. And we are searching for a house that has space for me to do my art in house instead of having to rent a studio space. And moving further down the line, I have applied for a few more international things that are, you know, not located in England, located in the UK, mm-hmm. but are out perhaps in the US, and I've applied for a few things maybe around Germany and Spain. Those are, I'm, you know, still waiting to hear back from them right now. It's all kind of in the jury process. Oh, I've just toured a space in Brighton, which would be excellent for my little coven to have their first international exhibition in. And it's a very low cost, and it's a really great art location. And I'm kind of gathering coven members now who think that they could possibly send their artwork to me or come in the summer. I'm looking around end of August for that. Mm-hmm. So those are the big things right now. And then I'm just so excited. I feel like so much art is going to pour out of me as soon as I get into my art space. I think I'm really going to end up having my head down and really working a lot, because I think I might be moving away from the straight portraiture that I was doing and going more towards what I did for the Biennale and much more paint on paper. So yeah. I'm looking forward to having the time and the space to realize all of those things and hopefully getting accepted into a larger space to build one of these big things that I want to build. And I will tell you all about that later.
I'm truly so excited. I cannot wait. And I'll tell you what, we may have to record part three, perhaps later on in the year or something. Like we can't just leave this here. We need to have the next stage in what's going on.
If I get the approval for this really big thing I want to build, then you are the first person that's going to hear about it, because I have been trying to, I have had this in mind since 2006, and for it to just kind of come out of me as soon as the Biennale was over, like, now's the time to do it. You have the space to do it. Mm-hmm. If I can get that somewhere, you'll hear about it for sure.
Well, then what I need to do is, like, save my pennies and come and see it in real life. Like, that would just be the best.
You know, you'll have a place to stay by then, because I will only be getting a house with a minimum of 3 bedrooms.
Perfect. Oh, Gina, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking time to join me again. Just before we wrap up, could you let the listeners know the best place to find you?
Oh, yes. So my website is GinaMarieCincinnati.com, and I believe you will be able to figure out that spelling when you look at the podcast title. otherwise, on Instagram, I am at A Woman Without a Country, and that's also my handle on TikTok. But basically, I think I'm posting more on Instagram, and TikTok is basically just getting all of the same videos and the same reels, just to a different audience.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Gina. Thank you so much. And I wish you luck with everything for the rest of the year.
Thank you. You too. And I'm really excited about all of the artists that I've heard so far on the podcast since my episode. I'm really enjoying listening to everything they have to say.
It's incredibly inspiring hearing from others.
I feel like you must get, I don't know about you, but for me personally, sometimes I have to put artist biographies down because they're too inspiring. And I wonder if sometimes you might suffer from, like, inspiration overload.
Yep. The problem. So it's like 9:06 PM right now, and my dogs want to be walked and I've got to get up early in the morning, but all I want to do is go and make art. Like, it's just, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that happens all the time.
Totally understand. Totally understand.
Oh, Gina, thank you so much.
Thank you too. Have a good evening and have a good dog walk.
Oh yes, definitely.
Would you be interested in making a one-off payment to support us? In return, you'd be helping to keep the podcast going and would also get access to our bonus episodes. Let me know what you think via Kim at artsupplyposse.com or via Instagram.